0870 60900. That's 0870 60 60900. BBC Radio 4 News.
From 26 parts of the globe, 26 short pieces inspired by the night.
It sounds like this.
From Australia to Zagreb.
It was during one of those winter nights when all sounds get clearer, like freezing air would give them a kind of sharpness.
Thinking Earth, an ABC of the night.
Die Nacht in Berlin ist lang.
On Saturday night.
Schlaf.
At 8.
Peter White is on the Great Wall of China. He'll tell you why in half an hour. First, it's time for a post-Christmas case notes with Dr. Mark Porter.
Hello. If you're feeling a bit dyspeptic after the excesses of Christmas, then today's programme is just what the doctor ordered, because it's all about indigestion, or heartburn, or dyspepsia. Call it what you will, it's an extremely common and often very distressing problem, and never more so than at this time of year. 4 out of 10 people will have suffered from dyspepsia at least once in the last 12 months. The vast majority of them never go near a doctor, preferring to self-medicate with over-the-counter remedies. And in a typical year, we spend over £100 million on such remedies. But are we spending our money wisely? And when should dyspepsia prompt a visit to the doctor rather than the pharmacist? Case Notes reporter Leslie Hilton finds out that children can suffer too, and talks to a surgeon who is pioneering a new operation that could provide a lifelong cure for adults as well as children. And if you suffer from a persistent nagging cough, particularly when you talk, laugh, or after you've eaten a meal, then it's probably due to a problem with your gullet rather than your chest, and there could be a surprisingly simple solution. I'll be meeting one of the world's leading authorities on acid reflux cough and finding out why his clinic in Hull has become so popular.
People come from all over the country, actually, from north of Scotland to Cornwall, they come and see us. So it's a symptom which drives people to desperation. You know, they'll even come to Hull.
My guest today is Brendan Delaney, Professor of Primary Care at the University of Birmingham, and he joins us from our studio in Edinburgh. Brendan, perhaps we should start by clearing up the confusion that surrounds the terminology. What do we mean by dyspepsia, and is it the same as indigestion and heartburn?
Well, it really depends who you talk to. Specialists have been very keen to split out gastroesophageal reflux disease, that is, symptoms of heartburn and acid reflux, so burning feeling coming up into the centre of the chest from the stomach, from dyspepsia, which is more of pain in the centre of the stomach just below the rib cage. Unfortunately, splitting them up in general practice doesn't really work very well because the individual symptoms aren't particularly predictive of any kind of underlying disorder, and you really need to have had a look down with an endoscope before you can really make sense of the individual symptoms that a patient has.
And the patients are coming to see the doctor because they've got a problem. It doesn't really matter which type it is, I suppose. What are the main causes of dyspepsia? Perhaps we can break them up in that way.
Well, unfortunately, the commonest cause is no cause found.
So often the case in medicine.
Yes, exactly. Or functional dyspepsia or functional reflux disease, depending on whether they've got predominant heartburn or epigastric pain. If there is a cause found, then at the moment the most common is esophagitis, or inflammation of the gullet, part of gastroesophageal reflux disease. And less than 10% of patients will have a peptic ulcer, either in the duodenum or the stomach. And then finally, on the very end, the rare causes. Overall, about 1% of patients will turn out to have a malignancy, either of the stomach or the esophagus.
So when you're talking about this functional dyspepsia, are we talking about an acid-related problem? Is it too much acid?
Well, in some patients, yes. We know that because if we suppress their acid production, they get better in a very empirical way. But a few patients who unfortunately don't respond to acid suppression can be quite a headache to manage, and we really don't know what causes their symptoms.
So this is a sort of irritable bowel affecting the upper part of the bowel, really?
Yes, or it could indeed be the lower part of the bowel, because, of course, it wraps around the stomach over the top anatomically, so localising pain could be quite difficult if someone's got upper abdominal bloating.
What about the role of overindulgence? I mean, people in the last few weeks, or certainly the last few days, have been overindulging, and dyspepsia, indigestion, certainly in general practice, seems to be much more common when people have been overdoing it.
I think particularly with reflux disease, if you've got heartburn, then if you fill your stomach up late at night with greasy food, which is going to be slow to empty, then you lie down flat, you're asking to get your heartburn. But you've got to have a predisposition to it to start with. And, you know, we can't just blame indigestion on lifestyle. There's an underlying problem.
What about pregnancy? Because heartburn is very common in pregnancy, isn't it?
Yes. I think almost all pregnant women will get heartburn at some stage during their pregnancy. It's caused by relaxation of the lower end of the gullet and obviously the increasing swelling of her abdomen.
When should sufferers seek help? We said that obviously most people self-medicate. Are there any sort of flags that should cause concern, that should make them see the doctor rather than the pharmacist?
Yes. The important thing to bear in mind, of course, even if you have one of these red flags, you're unlikely to have cancer, but you should still consult with your doctor, and that predominantly is, well, the most important is dysphagia. Now, that's a sensation of food sticking on swallowing. It's not just a sensation of discomfort, but an actual physical sensation that the food sticks. People who have unexplained weight loss in association with dyspepsia, or are diagnosed as being anemic and could perhaps have a bleeding stomach ulcer as the cause, they're all red flag symptoms and should lead both to a consultation with a GP and a reasonably rapid referral for an endoscopy.
And of course, if you mention those to a pharmacist, he or she should direct you to your GP. We'll leave it there for the moment, Brendan. Of course, the definitive first line investigation for working out what's causing dyspepsia is an endoscopy, looking around the gullet, stomach, and first part of the intestine, that's the duodenum, with a fibre optic endoscope. We caught up with Mary Ogden as she had an endoscopy performed by gastroenterologist Peter Fairclough at the Royal London Hospital in Whitechapel. Mary had been having trouble swallowing.
I was at a party and I couldn't get the food down. I'd eaten a lovely piece of roast beef and it stuck just about there. And I felt very hot and sweaty and embarrassed. And I had to leave the room and bring it up. That was it. Sometimes, you know, you start to have a little reflux, but it hasn't been bad. And particularly at night, you go to bed and you lie down and you suddenly feel it sort of a bit burny there. And I'd reach out and get a Rennie and that was it.
Fine, just pop up and have a seat on the edge of the bed. Open wide. That's good. Fine, swallow. And you remember that this will make the back of the mouth numb.
Yes.
Not nice tasting, is it?
Well, not bad. No. I've had worse.
It's not Dom Perignon, though. Lie up on the bed for me. Turn on your left shoulder and hip and face me.
Yes.
Now, I want you to hold this little piece of plastic between your teeth. That's it. And lean over, hold on to the edge of the bed with that hand. Okay, ready? No, I'll tell you what I'm doing. Just passing the telescope over the tongue and through the back of the mouth. And we're coming down in a second to the swallowing mechanism. And going through now. Just give a little swallow for me, Mary. That's it. Well done. Very good. Okay. Oops. So we're in the gullet now. Try and relax. Just get your breath. That's it. Well done. And just passing down the instrument, down the gullet now, and into the stomach now. You'll feel a little bit windy because I'm putting gas in the stomach. You okay there? Good, good. We're coming to the bottom end of the stomach now. Okay, sorry about that. Just going out of the stomach into the duodenum, and that looks normal. Bottom end of the stomach looks fine. I'm just bringing out the telescope now, little at a time, having a look as I go. I just suck some of the gas out of the stomach so you won't be too burpy. Okay, got a hiatus hernia and a little bit of narrowing going out of the stomach, out of the gullet into the stomach. And that's still healing up, I think, with the new treatment you've been having. Okay, some biopsy forceps, please. Just going to take some little samples in here. Are you okay there? Good. Right, this doesn't hurt. I'm just going to take a little sample. Open, please. Close. Okay, open again. Close. Okay, jolly good. Now, the reason for taking these samples is that the lining of your gullet has been damaged by the acid. And we just need to see exactly how much damage there is and whether we need to give you any different kind of treatment for it. All right, so I'm going to take the endoscope out now. It's come out through the back of the mouth. Well done. That's it. All finished.
Well, it's uncomfortable. It is not painful, but it is uncomfortable. But they are so lovely, and they look after you so well, and I wasn't waiting around a lot. They told me exactly what they were doing, but they didn't tell me that the noises would be so loud, because they're used to it, you see. But they did today. They told me it was gas, that they put gas into the stomach to hold it out. And so now I don't feel quite so embarrassed.
Mary Ogden and Dr. Peter Fairclough. You're listening to Case Notes. I'm Dr. Mark Porter, and I'm talking about dyspepsia with my guest, Professor Brendan Delaney. Brendan, Mary there had a hiatus hernia. That's quite a common finding in endoscopy, isn't it? Perhaps you could explain.
Well, basically, it means that the upper part of the stomach is pulled up slightly within to the chest, so it lies above the hiatus or the gap within the diaphragm, the muscle that separates the abdomen from the chest. And it's associated with heartburn symptoms, but isn't in itself an alarming diagnosis. And as you said, it's very common.
And that's because the valve that's of the stomach is no longer properly competent. It's allowing the stomach contents to come back up into the relatively delicate gullet, yeah?
Precisely.
Yeah. We haven't mentioned Helicobacter pylori yet, H. pylori, a discovery that really turned the world of gastroenterology on its head.
Yes, indeed. I think there were great hopes that eradication of H. pylori would eradicate dyspepsia. Unfortunately, for the majority of patients who have functional dyspepsia, this isn't the case. For example, if you have a duodenal ulcer and you have Helicobacter pylori, then that ulcer will keep on coming back year after year, and getting rid of your Helicobacter pylori will pretty much stop that. If you have functional dyspepsia, there's a small group of about 9% of patients who might benefit from H. pylori eradication, which makes it worth doing, but the vast majority won't.
So while Helicobacter pylori causes most ulcers, it doesn't cause most cases of indigestion, which was what was hoped originally, wasn't it, that you could cure someone forever from their indigestion by giving them a week's course of antibiotics?
That's right, indeed. There still is an argument that it might be a reasonable first-line strategy to do with patients who come up with dyspepsia. Let's test for H. pylori and treat it and see if it makes them better. And in fact, we're doing quite a large trial across the country funded by the Medical Research Council for that at the moment.
How many people carry H. pylori, middle-aged adults, for instance?
It runs along at about 10% minus your age, so a 40-year-old would have around a 30% chance of having it. However, it's heavily related to social class, higher socioeconomic groups. It's pretty rare. And if you were born in third world or grew up in poverty, then you're pretty much likely to have it, about 90%.
How important is diet and lifestyle? Does drinking too much, eating too much rich food and being overweight and perhaps smoking affect your chances of suffering from dyspepsia?
A bit. There are some weak associations between being overweight, smoking, and having a high alcohol intake. But what evidence there is that looks at whether actually reducing weight or stopping smoking makes much difference is very inconclusive.
Now, on prescription, we basically can't offer anything much different than you can buy over the counter. You can buy the strongest group of drugs, the proton pump inhibitors, omeprazole, across the counter now. So why would people come to the doctor? What can you get from the doctor in terms of medicines to relieve your symptoms?
Well, I think for a start, the over-the-counter license for proton pump inhibitors is quite limited. It's no more than a couple of weeks of treatment, and that's on the advice of a pharmacist. So if you're going to enter a long-term usage, then a consultation with a GP who can check for any alarm symptoms, give you some advice about your symptoms and advise you how to take the medication, and of course it's much cheaper on prescription, is quite sensible.
Is there a downside to suppressing stomach acid production long-term?
Well, this was raised when proton pump inhibitors were first produced, but there's been long experience of the drugs now, about 10 years, and the answer is, in essence, no.
Well, dyspepsia isn't only a problem in adults. Children can suffer too, and sometimes severely enough to warrant surgery, as Leslie Hilton discovered when she met David Beadle.
Would you prefer the spelt or the spelt and sunflower or the spelt and rye?
I think I'd have to have the spelt, please.
Spelt, okay, yeah. I'll do that then. Right, is there anything else you
feel like? Oh, well, we need some live yoghurt. Getting low. Oh, yes.
David Beadle is 17. He's had acid reflux for a couple of years, and it makes his life a misery at times.
I started getting burning in the bottom of my throat, almost as though one was vomiting. It was very strong, kind of burning. And there was a pause not long ago where it wasn't so bad, but since then it's been getting worse and worse. And if I don't have the drugs, I have Zoton and Nexium sometimes. When I don't have those drugs, it's much worse, I guess, than it normally is. When I have the drugs, I might have a bit of regurgitation. I have a lot when I don't have them, and I burn in the bottom of my throat, and I get some heartburn as well, especially if I have perhaps a lot of liquid and solid together, maybe if I have cereal in the morning.
Such an acute form of acid reflux in a child or young person is uncommon. Children don't usually have the same diet and lifestyle habits as adults. Dr. Mike Thompson is a consultant paediatric gastroenterologist at the Sheffield Children's Hospital.
The disease of reflux, acid from the stomach coming up into the swallowing tube, is not exactly the same as the adult disease, but it has some similarities. For instance, alcohol and tobacco are clearly not issues, generally speaking, in paediatrics, but there are certain situations that the similarities occur in. For instance, the child will have the tight area at the top of the stomach, which is a valve, which may not be competent, and that's the main problem.
Despite drastically changing his diet and trying complementary therapies like acupuncture and homeopathy, David has lost over 2 stone in weight in the last year and a half. He's now on the waiting list to have a fundoplication operation through keyhole surgery. This has been the only treatment for serious cases for some years and involves wrapping the upper part of the stomach around the lower part of the esophagus. It's a relatively major procedure, which is irreversible, and carries the possibility of problems afterwards, such as the inability to burp or vomit and problems with swallowing. David's mother, Sally, is very worried about the risks involved.
The fundoplication operation means that they'd make 5 holes in him to do his keyhole surgery operation, and there's a risk anyway with making 5 holes in somebody that something could be damaged on the way. I know there's a very high success rate, but as the surgeon said, there's a 1% chance of the stomach or the esophagus being punctured. Of course, that is only 1%, but if you're that 1%, then it's 100% for you. So there's a worry that he might not be able to burp or vomit after, which some people would say would be a blessing. But, you know, imagine actually if you had a stomach bug and you couldn't be sick. I think it would be pretty bad.
Hello, James. How are you?
Fine.
How's your tummy?
It has hurt a little bit before.
It's only been a couple of weeks, so I'm very pleased with the way you're coping with this. Well done. You're very, very grown up. Very brave.
6-year-old James Watts has had acid reflux since birth. As a baby, he had severe projectile vomiting and couldn't eat solid foods. Doctors thought it was a form of food phobia, and he's only recently been properly diagnosed. His mother, Justin, says the condition has had a serious effect on his quality of life.
To look at physically, he just never really looked like a particularly healthy child. He's always been tall for his age, but very skinny and very pale, and basically not as much energy as a child of his age would normally have. But more than anything, it's the constant tummy aches and feeling of sickness that he's had for as long as we can remember.
But in Sheffield, Mike Thompson has developed a far less invasive technique that's fully reversible.
We're going to just separate ourselves from the tissue, go back into the stomach and close the chamber. And hopefully, when we pull out the scope, this loop that Andy is holding will pass down into the esophagus. So this means we've made a successful second suture. We
now James Watts has just had this new procedure. Mike Thompson describes how it's done.
A little sewing machine is put on the end of an endoscope, which is passed when the child is asleep under a short light general anaesthetic down into the swallowing tube, the esophagus. And it's passed down to just below where the esophagus enters the stomach. And 6 stitches, 3 pairs of 2, are made, and these 3 pairs are tied together, creating a little bit like a purse string effect, if you like. But there is no operation as such, no incisions on the abdomen, and this is undoable if need be and is not necessarily a permanent fixture.
Mike Thompson says this type of endoscopic funduplication has proved highly effective in the 30 children aged between 6 and 16 treated over the past year. 25 of them are now off medication completely. James was the youngest child to be treated. So how does his mother feel about him having a procedure which is still in its infancy?
I don't think that technology would advance very much unless people are prepared to undergo something that is not as tried and tested as a lot of the older procedures. But certainly the alternative we were given, which is an open operation, I don't think that James as an individual would have coped with either emotionally or physically. There's no choice as far as we were concerned as parents. This was the route we wanted to go.
James Watts's mother, Justine, talking to Leslie Hilton. Brendan, I think most people will be surprised that dyspepsia symptoms can be severe enough to warrant surgery, but in pronounced cases, they really can affect your quality of life, can't they?
Indeed. Evidence shows that for severe patients, it can be as bad an impact on quality of life as having heart disease or angina.
Do you think that laparoscopic funduplication is going to be something we're going to be offering more of?
Basically, no. I think the difficulty with all surgical procedures is, as you've heard here in the example of 30 cases, in the hands of an expert with very selected numbers of patients, it appears to do well. You move it out into the general population of less selected patients, more general surgeons, it doesn't do as well and it doesn't get uptake.
Well, so far, we've only looked at the more obvious consequences of dyspepsia, but gastric juices in the wrong place can cause more than heartburn. Professor Alan Maurice from the University of Hull is a world authority on long-term cough associated with backflow of stomach juices into the gullet, so-called acid reflux cough, a common and often missed cause of persistent and troublesome cough. I started off by asking him who's most likely to be affected.
It seems that women have a heightened cough reflex, and this is one of the reasons why they tend to come. And it tends to be a condition which comes on as you get older, perhaps because you put on a bit more weight.
And how many people do you think across the country are suffering from it?
Well, there was a large survey done by the European Respiratory Society, and they reckon about 1 in 10 people have a chronic cough.
And what proportion of those people with chronic cough do you think have got acid reflux cough?
The majority, I would say. There's one or two who have asthma as well, but usually the asthma is sorted out when they go and see the doctor, because the doctor immediately assumes that the cough is due to asthma. And so they almost invariably have had asthma treatment, and when they come and see me, the first thing I do is stop all the asthma treatment, and usually nothing happens.
Conventional wisdom has it that the key symptom of reflux is heartburn, you know, the acid coming out of the stomach burns the relatively delicate lining of the unprotected gullet. But in these people, they can just have cough, can't they?
That's right. Only about half the patients with the reflux cough actually have the heartburn. And often the doctor says it can't be reflux because they don't have the heartburn, but it's not true. Isolated cough can be the only symptom of reflux.
And are there any characteristic telltale signs that the patient or the doctor should look out for that would point towards an acid-related cough, rather than perhaps asthma or some other common cause?
Yeah, recently I've gone away from doing tests because I think that the history, as we call it, what the patient tells you, is the characteristic feature. So that the cough tends to go away at night because the valve tightens up at night, then the patient wakes up. And unlike an asthmatic who wakes up coughing, the patient will often wake without a cough, but it's when they get out of bed or move over in bed, and that's the valve opening to allow for the gas that's accumulated in the stomach overnight to be released. And then they get a cough, sometimes with dry food, and that's a reflex from the back of the throat going down to open the valve. And particularly cough after food as well. So about 5 to 10 minutes after eating, people start coughing. When you eat, you swallow air, and the body naturally opens the valve to allow that air out after you've finished eating, and that causes the reflux at the same time. Other symptoms are hoarseness of the voice. And when you're talking or on the telephone, laughing is another one. That's because the diaphragm normally holds the valve closed, and when you're using your diaphragm to make the words, that allows the reflux to whip past.
And what about treatment?
The conventional treatment for heartburn is drugs which block acid. And they do work, but they, for some reason, I don't really understand, they take a longer to work. And they're not quite as successful because whilst heartburn, you need to burn the gullet, as you've said. With reflux cough, if it's reflux going up to your vocal cords and landing on your voice box. Well, it doesn't really matter if it's too acid at all, really. It'll make you cough. So there's other things that we have to give which deal with the movement of the gullet. They tend to be the sort of second-line treatment if the acid treatment doesn't work, or antacid treatment.
So using antacid treatments, and we use drugs like the proton pump inhibitors, or PPIs, as then, and drugs like omeprazole and lansoprazole, very commonly prescribed drugs, they may not have an immediate effect, and indeed they may not get rid of the cough altogether.
Correct. And also, most doctors tend to give them once a day, whereas, in fact, they only last in the body for about an hour and a half. So whilst once a day will block sufficient acid to prevent heartburn, in reflux cough, where you're trying to block all of the acid, you need to give them twice a day. And indeed, we've gone over to giving them twice a day and another type of tablet, ranitidine, at night to block all of the acid. I mean, I saw a lady last Thursday in my cough clinic, and she'd had a cough for 66 years. And the poor lady was doubly incontinent with it, and we made her better with the baclofen, which works on the movement of the gullet.
And how quickly did her symptoms clear?
It took about 2 weeks for her to get better, but the key was to understand the origin of the cough to provide the specific therapy. When we can't get people better with that, we've just done a study looking at low doses of morphine, and that seems very effective in people who have intractable reflux cough.
Professor Alan Maurice, who's written a definitive guide to coughs and their treatment, which can be accessed for free via the internet, well worth reading. Check out our website, bbc.co.uk/radio4, for details. Brendan, perhaps we should finish by reiterating advice for the vast majority of people who self-medicate with dyspepsia remedies from their pharmacist. If you had to go for an over-the-counter remedy, which one would you go for?
I think there are two things. If you want instant relief from waking up in the middle of the night with symptoms, then an antacid or an alginate will give you that instant relief.
Those are the white medicines, aren't they, and the liquids, so tablets and liquids. When would you use a PPI, the omeprazole? Because they're very expensive, aren't they? You can only buy a few as well.
Yeah, so if you're waking up on consecutive nights, right, or you've got symptoms during the day, you want something you can take for a few days at a time, or perhaps in anticipation of an event which might cause you heartburn in the middle of the night.
And when should your indigestion or heartburn, perhaps before New Year's Eve is what you're saying there, and when should your indigestion or heartburn ring alarm bells and warrant an appointment, perhaps with the GP instead of the pharmacist?
Well, back in the summer, the National Institute of Clinical Excellence, the NHS body that issues guidance to doctors, produced new guidance on this area. And in essence, it's patients of any age with unexplained weight loss with dyspepsia or dysphagia, the food sticking as we've described earlier, then specifically in older patients, say over the age of 55, if they've got recurrent symptoms, not settling down on initial acid suppression, and particularly people who've got a family history of stomach cancer or have had an endoscopy in the past which has shown something called Barrett's esophagus.
Of course, the vast majority of people who do need to see their doctor is about optimising treatment rather than finding anything sinister.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, Nice said that optimal treatment would be on-demand, patient self-managed use of a proton pump inhibitor rather than taking it continuously.
And the NHS would like that, presumably, as well, because we spend something like, well, nearly £500 million, don't we, on indigestion remedies, and proton pump inhibitors take a large slice of that.
Yes, and particularly if you've got functional heartburn, you can probably get away with taking your medication only on a third of the time.
Well, Professor Brendan Delaney, that's all we have time for. Thank you very much. Next week's programme is about respiratory problems, including chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD, an often forgotten condition that can have serious implications for the 1 in 6 people over 40 who develop it. And, on a slightly different note, could playing the recorder help your child's asthma?
Case Notes was presented by Dr. Mark Porter, and the producer was Paula McGrath. Now, if you have a question arising from tonight's programme, you can call the Radio 4 Action Line on 0800 044 044. In October of this year, the Canadian submarine HMCS Chicoutimi left Scotland for home. 4 days into its maiden voyage, a fire broke out, causing the death of Lieutenant Chris Saunders and leaving 54 other crew members fighting to save their vessel and their lives. BBC Radio 4 has been granted unique access to the crew of the ill-fated submarine.
There was a series of pops that, and then the compartment started to fill full of smoke down where we were. So there was no mistaking it then. When you see smoke curling along the deckhead towards you, it takes all question of an exercise right out of your head. You know right away that it's the real deal.
John Waite presents It's My Story on Thursday evening at 8 o'clock. Well, now on BBC Radio 4 with a specially extended edition of In Touch, here's Peter White.
Hello. What have all these places got in common? The Olympic stadiums at Atlanta, Sydney and Athens, a large New York bookshop, the Hampshire Wood at midnight, and the European Parliament building at Strasbourg. Well, they've all provided the setting for the